Good morning, James.
Good morning, Mark.
Nice to be here with you on Blogging Heads. I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm the executive editor of the American Prospect magazine, and I'm here with James Polos. Why don't you actually introduce yourself, because you have a lot of... I don't know which of your many hats goes first. You're a classic Washington figure with many, many things going on.
Right. I'm the founding editor of Postmodern Conservative, which is now hosted at First Things. I'm also doing doctoral work in my infinite spare time at Georgetown University.
Okay, great. And you used to blog on American Scene also?
Yeah, still do.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's where I've most often read your work. Well, we have been asked by the Blogging Heads bureaucracy. The order came down through the many layers to talk about the legacy of Irving Kristol, who passed away at the end of last week at the age of 89, and obviously a very, very important figure for conservative thought, and also a very important figure for liberals to engage with. Not entirely because he was a neoconservative whose roots were originally more on the left. But why don't you, James, why don't you talk a little bit about how you see Kristol's legacy and significance, you know, then as it relates to the current American scene?
Well, yeah. I mean, Amity Schlaes had a Bloomberg piece where she sort of summed up her take on Kristol. And I think it was well put at the end when she indicated that, you know, as young people, especially, you know, center-right, move forward looking for not only leaders for their own to claim as their own, but to sort of step into the limelight in their own right as leaders. They might not refer to themselves as neoconservatives. That label might not endure as long as Irving Kristol's own legacy. So in a way, I think this is a point well taken. Irving Kristol, the man, and Irving Kristol, the maker of networks, might have a legacy that endures longer than, you know, we've now got sort of first-stage neoconservatism and second-stage neoconservatism, and the label might pass more quickly than the ideas or the passions behind it.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the label is a mess and has been one for a long time, because people will say, you know, I mean, originally, and I had an old copy of that book, The Neoconservatives, which is, you know, I think it's almost 30 years old now, that talks about the founding generation that includes, you know, includes Kristol, but also includes Nat Glaser and Pat Moynihan and Daniel Bell and so forth. People who really never made the full move to the right at all that Kristol made. And so they're called neoconservatives from a particular moment in time, the original public interest group, who were really kind of skeptical liberals. And then there's another thing called the neoconservatives, which really has, I mean, it has certain people like Kristol and Podhoretz who run through the whole chain, but really is a totally different configuration of people. It's much more focused on foreign policy, you know, much more intensely anti-liberal. I mean, in a way, Kristol went from skeptical liberal to super anti-liberal over that course of time. I mean, I don't know how useful that term neoconservative is anymore for describing that whole anything other than, you know, Kristol and maybe Podhoretz themselves.
Well, I think it's somewhat funny. I mean, people are already starting to openly question whether or not conservative means too many things now for it to be a kind of moniker that anyone wants to hang around their own necks. But it's interesting because you're getting it from both directions, and I think this is illustrative of both the weaknesses or the precariousness of Irving Kristol's neoconservatism and its strengths. So you get a guy like Fukuyama, who's, you know, pretty publicly sort of backed away from this label and said, wait a minute, you know, this is my sort of personal intellectual project, and we're not marching in lockstep here, and, you know, the quote-unquote neocons have made this series of blunders. But then you also have, you know, on the other side, people saying that, you know, oh, to be a neocon isn't to be a conservative, and vice versa, and, you know, of course we all have at least some impression of why that's so, and Kristol did too. So even though, you know, throughout his career he drew stark distinctions between his own position and that of the old right, or the, you know, the European conservatism, as I think he he liked to characterize it. You know, this is also the same guy who said rather proudly later on in his career, you know, oh, in my family, they're just conservatives. The neoconservatives have just become mainstream. And I think that there's a lot to be said for the accuracy of that remark, however tongue-in-cheek it might have been. There is a way in which America is, in Crystal's sense, very much a neoconservative country, and that the moderate ground that he attempted to stake out, I think, is one that finds itself stubbornly entrenched in what consensus there is in America today, to the frustration of people on the left and the right.
Well, what's the moderate ground of Crystal? I mean, I have an answer to that, but it goes way, way back. I mean, how do you define Crystal as a moderate?
Well, I think his attitude toward the budget, for instance, which was, oh, you know, we didn't have a lot of economists, if any, at the public interest, and that's because, you know, we think about things more historically than we do sociologically or economically. You know, I have sort of, my issue with that is more coming from the political theorist / social theorist side of things. But I do think his ecumenical or even, you know, at its worst, cavalier attitude about budgetary spending is one that, for good or for ill, has been one of the few areas where Americans have found themselves to be in general agreement, I think, despite, you know, the anxiety that has accompanied, you know, stacking billions upon billions, and, you know, mm-hmm. what happened in September of last year obviously changes that landscape. But, you know, I think if there's one aspect of Crystal's neoconservatism that's been if someone could accuse it of being an immoderate position, but I think that relative to the partisan left and the partisan right, it's turned out to be the sort of consensus position, oh, it doesn't matter how much the budget grows as long as we're sort of checking the right boxes and doing these other important things, that most of America has been willing to go along with now for some time.
Right. Okay, well, I'll challenge that a little bit. I mean, what you're describing Crystal as is the classic, political science concept of that Americans are operational liberals and ideological conservatives.
Right.
That's identified with Lloyd Free and what's it, Hadley Cantrill. This is from Downtown. You're identifying him in that tradition. I would say something different, which is that I think Crystal was interesting as the guy who married traditional business conservatism. He kind of brought Wall Street into the conservative movement, you know, and created some of those connections where a conservative, the Goldwater conservative, the traditional movement conservatism of Paul Weyrich and the original circle of people around, say, the Heritage Foundation, was not, you know, didn't have a comfortable relationship with the kind of Chamber of Commerce type actual conservatives, and Crystal married those, and one of the ways to marry those was really just a politics of radical tax cutting, so that he brings Winiski into the fold. I mean, so yes, they don't care about the budget, although they do care about kind of delivering these tax cuts to a fairly wealthy group of people, and making that something that becomes part of the conservative agenda for people who are actually in it as much for social policy reasons as economic reasons. I mean, he seems like, in a way, Crystal is almost like the guiding spirit of what the American Enterprise Institute is today.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's right, that the tax cuts went from being sort of a way of extending the coalition to sort of the basis upon which that coalition ultimately justified itself in a lot of ways. But, you know, I would hearken back to the Clinton years and say, you know, okay, these weren't this wasn't an era of, you know, quote unquote massive tax cuts for the wealthy, but it was an era when I think the pendulum within the Democratic Party swung pretty firmly in Crystal's direction relative to both what came before and perhaps what's coming after, which, you know, it's still not exactly clear what's going to pan out. But the Clinton Democratic Party was, I think, as hospitable a place for crystal liberals or conservative liberals, as I think he called himself at some other time, had been, and it may be as hospitable a place as we'll see on the left.
Why wouldn't a crystal or his son or others in that circle kind of relax and feel comfortable in the mid period Clinton world or the world we're in now? I can sort of see that case. I mean, it's a case that yes, it's a more conservative version of liberalism.
Well, I mean, this was the era of welfare reform. This was the era of V-chip. Right. This was the era of, you know, Joe Lieberman being a major party figure. Al Gore. This was the Al Gore who's prior to the bearded Al Gore with which we became familiar. It was a different Democratic.
The Al Gore, the really despicable Al Gore of 1988. Yeah.
So you know, when I look at the way neoconservatism, as Crystal imagined it, lined up with the right versus the left, I think there was a period of time during the 90s when, despite what was going on, sort of on the radical cultural vanguard of the left, the sort of thing that would get grassroots conservatives out in the streets. What was going on in terms of governance and in terms of the approach to governing was, not something that was obviously good enough or appealing enough for Crystal and his ilk. But I think, with an eye toward foreign policy and sort of democratic interventionism, obviously of a cheaper and smaller footprint variety than what we wound up with. Right. And domestic policy, cautiously paternalistic when it came to values and safe, legal, and rare was the mantra for abortion. And, some of its tone, but a lot of its policy too. And targeted tax cuts aren't the sort of thing that you can get Lafferites to rally around, but for a Democratic president or a liberal administration, I think that it's as much in line with the idea that that the economic way forward is to make as many people in America wealthy enough so that you can supply that you can sort of organize their support around a robust framework of targeted tax cuts as anything that that's come down the pike since.
I mean, I agree with that. I mean, I think that's as domestic policy, that's a response. I think there are two things. That was a response both to, the large political tides that pushed that created only certain options for Clinton, and it was also a reaction in a sense to something more like the original neocons, the public interest neocons, which is, a liberalism that's really a little bit chastened and doesn't have grand world-changing visions anymore. That doesn't imagine, we'll just, do maximum community involvement and it's not going to create an office of economic opportunity or something like that and create these kind of schemes for human betterment. It's some of the political circumstances, but I don't see Crystal or fitting into that story at all. I do see him. I mean, I think on foreign policy it's a little different because there it's almost more of an intellectual journey that a lot of people made on the left. A lot of people wrote about, people like Paul Berman, that journey towards a sense of the need for American intervention in certain situations. Really, it was transformative to a lot of liberals, or somebody like Michael Ignatieff. Up in Canada. I mean, they're making, I think, a transition that's somewhat like the neocon transition, and that's where you saw a lot of confluence of interest, especially in that 1998-99 period, as people sort of absorb those lessons. But I don't really see it in domestic policy, other than to say, yeah, domestic policy isn't all that left, which is true. But I'm not sure Crystal has much to do with it.
Well, I suppose that the distinction that I'd hark back to is Crystal's very laissez-faire attitude toward economic growth in government, and his very suspicious and antagonistic posture toward political growth, or toward the growth of the administrative state. Despite the fact that he's the guy who came out and said, look, if you care about culture, if you care about artistic value, if you care about civilization, then you've got to be for censorship. Obviously this isn't the kind of thing that's going to fit in on the left, although, you did have VCHIP and you did have Tipper Gore and you did have that sort of thing. There was that kind of values Democrat constituency for a hot minute.
Right, right. Okay, I guess I can see a little of that confluence. What would you say is crystal? Like, what's the book or the essay of Crystal's that you think, really marks his intellectual importance? And if somebody wanted to read one thing,
that kind of
supports your interpretation of him.
Yeah, I was looking through things last night, just taking a walk down memory lane. He did an interview with the American Spectator back when it was The Alternative. Bob Tyrrell interviewed him, and it's an interesting.
Back when the name of the magazine was The Alternative, based in Indiana or something like that.
It was the campus newspaper.
Yeah.
Back before it became The Spectator, but Crystal says some interesting things, and of course it's Tyrrell can be a fun guy to throw questions at people. And so he poses, I'll just, read a little bit since I got it right in front of me, but Tyrrell says, aren't our traditional values, being corrupted, and isn't Western civilization about to fall apart from exhaustion? And Crystal says, and I think this is revealing, sort of from a wide lens view, he says, I don't know what that means. Civilizations have a way of not falling apart all that easily. Are our values corrupt? In a way, they are. I don't know that they're more corrupt than the values of other civilizations, though I might even concede that in some senses they are. And then he goes on to say, on the other hand, these are the values that regulate the way we live together. And even if they may be false in certain important respects, they simply can't be shoved aside. People cannot live in a vacuum. False values are better than none. And until these values are amended and improved, we'll have to cope with them as best we can. Now, it seems to me that that's the legacy of Crystal and first wave neocons, disaffected liberals, who were trying to reconcile themselves to the fact that they were profoundly concerned with the cultural radicalism that they'd seen taking place on the left, but they weren't reconciled to dominant to the values that dominated on the right necessarily. And they occupied this sort of unusual, and here, the influence of Leo Strauss, it may be significant. Secular liberals who are culturally conservative found themselves trying to reposition themselves in the wake of this radical moment in the 60s. Crystal here is saying, look, there might be some serious problems with, American values broadly understood. There might be some serious injustices on our hands. I'm not trending toward the right because I think this is the promised land. But I am willing to try to work through the problems that we are facing today with a set of people who, I think more or less have it right. They have their heart in the right place, or their instincts are right. Even if, when you sort of get down to the grassroots level, you go, oh gosh, these people are rubes, or their morals are so coarse, which is something that Tocqueville remarked upon hundreds of years ago.
Right. Well, so it's, and I guess you're right in that quote, what's that, early 80s or late 70s that would be?
I'm looking for a date. Yeah, it was 70s.
Yeah, it's, the one, I think the only Crystal book that I ever read, I think I read it when I was in college, was the book called Two Cheers for Capitalism.
Uh-huh.
Which I think reflected a similar attitude, maybe a spot in that journey that he was in that evolution that he was on. And I found it to be, you know, it was in a period in my life when I was sort of trying to understand a little bit more about what conservatism was about. And I think it's a, you know, it's a book I've seen some people refer to in the obituaries and in thinking about him, because it's, I think it reflects that sense, that, you know, recognition that totally unfettered capitalism has cultural consequences, and if you're actually concerned about the culture, that's where you take away the third cheer for, although it doesn't give you that much of a solution. But I think it had a similar, as I recall the book, it had a similar tone to that interview, which is a real, there's a little bit more, there's actually a little bit more European conservatism in that tone of, you know, there are things in culture that you just want to preserve. There's a kind of Burkean or Tory attitude there, I think.
Right. May 69 that
Wow, that's really, yeah.
Yeah, that interview was done. Clearly that continued sort of into the 70s.
Right.
He had another piece in the Public Interest called Capitalism, Socialism, and Nihilism, where he, you know, basically worked through that idea at a little bit more length and said, you know, it's socialism isn't the threat to capitalism in America today. It's nihilism. And
right.
He was starting to try and work through the way in which capitalism sort of taken to enlisted in the service of extreme, you know, libertinism could contribute as much to nihilism as the kind of Rousseauian collective spirit that he saw coming out of the left that was on its face anti-capitalistic, but fed into the same sort of nihilistic attitude that was also at the same time being sort of fed or reinforced by some of the things that were going on in the marketplace.
Right. And yet, you know, he's one of those conservatives, and it's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of things that he lived through, right? I mean, he's somebody who was, you know, when he was editor of Encounter magazine and so forth, I mean, he was up close to the liberal anti-communism in European liberal anti-communism as well as funded by Americans. He saw post-war Europe, he understood that change. He understood the kind of limits of liberalism in the 60s. But there's a particular type of neoconservative. The thing that really pushed him was just, you know, a sense of sexual license and the Woodstock or whatever, I guess, and then what you saw thereafter seemed to drive him more than a real response to policy.
Right, dirty movies, fine. Dirty books.
Yeah.
Dirty art.
Right. And I think it's often hard to quite relate to that. I think it's maybe a product of, you know, a particular kind of culture that you grow up in where, you know, education, you know, you take education extremely seriously, and then there was this generation that seemed to take it not so seriously. And they wanted their own, you know, they wanted to have their own ideas about what their classes should be and things like that. I find, maybe you don't, but I find it hard to sort of capture that, how strongly that drove certain people. I mean, I know there are people like that. I mean, you know, there are people who, you know, were, you know, moderately liberal professors and, you know, at Cornell or Columbia, and then, you know, all hell broke loose and they swung hard in reaction.
As an academic matter, there is this question here, which is, what is culture? And
right.
It was the counterculture just a different culture, or was it really an anti-culture? Was it antagonistic at its root to the things that you need to have in place in terms of authority, for lack of a better word, in order to have a culture? I think that this is not only just kind of an extremely interesting and relevant academic question, and I would commend Philip Reif to anyone who wants to to go down that road of study. But
commending Reef for what reason? Like what of Reef and for what?
Well, Reef is the Reef is the American sociologist who was married to Susan Sontag, and wrote a series of books. His first one was on Freud. He sort of wrote the book on Freud, and over the course of the 60s and 70s, he moved decisively away from polite academia, and was one of these was one of these secular Jews for culture. Who was made considerably more reactionary than a guy like Crystal, to the point where his focus in the latter half of his productive career was almost entirely on trying to work out what he called a sociology of the sacred, and trying to understand sort of what it was about authority that made culture possible. And from that perspective, he saw the radical cultural left as being not just an alternate culture, but interested in destroying what it was that made culture possible.
Mm-hmm. Now, am I correct? This is a couple books that actually were published fairly recently, right, and hadn't?
That's right. There was a trilogy that came out through University of Virginia Press. The first book was called My Life Among the Deathworks. The second book was called The Crisis of the Officer Class. And the third book is actually a collection of his more explicitly Jewish or Jewish-themed writings. Mm-hmm. Okay. I bring him up because I think there is this, in addition to being this sort of interesting academic question, a serious problem for anyone trying to carry the colors in Crystal's wake, as far as this point is concerned, because as any, as my libertarian friends will tell me, right, the America didn't just sort of slouch off to Gomorrah and die. Actually, all of these highly transgressive phenomena that developed in the 70s and the 80s were somewhat domesticated and went mainstream, and, right. America isn't crawling with serial killers. When you look at the kinds of things that were going on back then, Patty Hearst and Mapplethorpe and Ted Bundy, and, from at that time, it looked a lot more plausible than it does today that America culturally was about to fall apart. Now today, it seems that we can actually manage dirty books, dirty movies, and dirty theater a lot better right. than a guy like Crystal or a guy like Reef would have ever suspected or hoped, really.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think that's why I think that kernel of Crystal's reaction, and I haven't read, I've read none of Reef, I find it very hard to relate to. Partly, I mean, I don't know that point where we felt like, America was going to fall apart, at least not for those reasons. I mean, there were tragic things that happened in each of the decades I've been alive, and some of them were chaos, obviously some with tremendous chaos, but I didn't really see that this as, nihilism, and it's hard to relate to somebody who does, except to say, well, they're, from a different time or whatever. It doesn't seem to me much of the basis for a political theory, but I mean, in some ways, it seems like it is to you. I mean, I read some of the things you wrote about Michael Gerson's column about, arguing that young people should just get married early and, quit having so much damn sex, and I think you also wrote a little bit recently about that argument that the license of the 70s is sort of domesticated, which it totally is domesticated. I mean, I think there's a lot of, I feel like, young people, and I'm an officer of young people, young people are actually quite conservative in their own sense of their lives, in many ways, even though they might have, more sexual partners before marriage than Irving Kristol did,
But well, right. That doesn't seem to be a measure of anything.
Or more likely to be, they're obviously happily openly gay if they're openly gay, but that seems to me all very compatible with a very conservative view of the world.
Well, there's an issue here, right? Because the typical, at least I think I'm right in saying this nowadays, the typical conservative counterattack to the sort of libertarian position that we've just been discussing is, well, yes, it turns out that we are resilient enough to, in Nietzsche's language, sort of carry all this corruption and still manage to overcome it and live more or less reasonably well-adjusted bourgeois lives. But, say conservatives, this is actually really harmful to human dignity. So you might be, maintaining a certain standard of living, and you might be feeling self-actualized in a certain way, but there's this thing about people, there's a human nature, and it includes this basic human dignity, and this kind of licentious behavior is eroding it, and that's why it should stop.
I think that at
a certain point, conservatives are going to have to consider the possibility that if you're going to make that kind of argument, you need to be arguing from a concept of nobility and not dignity. I'm not sure that the dignity argument is going to be a winner. And I think that if you're going to say, look, sex is a lot of fun, right? But if you sort of blow your 20s just sleeping your way across, America or whatever college campuses you're on, you're going to wake up one day in your 30s and go, gosh, could I have reached for something a little higher? Could I have sort of treated myself in a way that today I'd feel a little bit more proud of? That's an argument.
I remember in Seinfeld when George Costanza's mother says, treated your body like an amusement park.
Right, exactly. But that's a different kind of argument than the one that's typically being made, which is, human dignity, human dignity. And a lot of that's coming out of, some of the work that conservatives are doing right now on bioethics, where I think it might get a little more purchase when you're talking about, designer babies and my parents saying, we want a pole vaulter, right? So we're going to breed ourselves a pole vaulter. And in some deep way, that does seem to problematize what it is that we think of when we think of the inherent dignity of a human being, being sort of the personal project of someone else in a way that reaches down into the building blocks of life. It doesn't translate as well, I don't think, into these sexual mores questions. Look for arguments from the right in the future. Arguing from nobility, I would say, is a growth industry.
Well, what's an argument from nobility? I'm not even sure.
One of my favorite examples from a couple of years ago is, Annie Leibovitz took this. It was the first sexualized or sensual photograph of Miley Cyrus, right, where she's barebacked and has this toga-esque length of cloth draped over her, and many conservatives predictably were outraged, and oh, she's 16 years old, and we all know what this is about here, and this is outrageous, and her father never should have let this happen, and so on and so forth. And I made the argument then that if we had more beautiful semi-nude pictures of beautiful young girls, fewer pictures of these kinds of girls, shot in the style of Maxim, or fewer Megan Foxes, right, and more beautiful semi-nude renditions of girls in the prime of their lives, that would not be, that wouldn't be an index of cultural corruption. That would actually be an index of a more ennobled vision of beauty and of sex, frankly, than the sort of thing that you get from the Maxims and the Rolling Stones of the world.
I'm not sure I get where you're going with this. I mean,
well, so you compare the Miley Cyrus of a few weeks ago or a month ago, when the scandal is, she comes out on this little ice cream cart that has a pole coming out of the top of it, and she does this perfunctory pole dance on it,
right.
Right? Which is whatever it is, it's not a very noble way of dancing, let's say. Whereas an artfully framed, an artfully presented semi-nude photograph might actually be, you know, quote-unquote just as sexual, but presenting sex and presenting beauty in a way that I think we can have an intelligible conversation about being more ennobling rather right. than less ennobling.
So it's the difference between, you know, Botticelli's Venus and, you know, Megan Fox in Maxim.
Right. And, you know, and I think that that's, I think that that's a legitimate conversation to have. And I don't think it's the kind of conversation where we're going to find ourselves just being thrown back on the idea that, well, you know, that's just your opinion and it's all a question of taste and, you know, we all have our kinks and whatever gets you on. You know, it's that kind of approach to cultural questions that I do think, you know, Crystal was very right to say, look, this is pointing toward nihilism when the possibility for having arguments about what's good and what's bad is either a political argument where, you know, I think this is bad, so I'm going to pass a law that makes it illegal, or no argument at all, which is, you know, if this is just a purely private matter, even though it's in public everywhere you go, and there's no way that we can have a constructive conversation about, you know, better and worse. It's just all a matter of pure personal preference.
Right. Right. Okay. I mean, I see that. I mean, I'm going to be in the anything goes camp pretty much whichever argument you use. I mean, I it's not like one works better for me. I mean, I could see the point. I mean, I guess where we've gotten to, and this is a sense in which I don't think we're living in Irving Kristol's world at all. What we've gotten to is a place where there's a wide agreement that there, you know, the line that matters is the line between childhood and adulthood. So, you know, anything that sexualizes a Miley Cyrus or whatever is problematic for you know, in some sense, and anything that, you know, and whereas with Megan Fox, who's whatever 5 years older or something like that, you know, nothing matters. So that line, which is probably not the most relevant line, becomes the one that matters. But I don't really get it as a larger cultural construct. I mean, there's a lot of cultural issues that we argue about, which are, how does that relate? I guess let's go back to the Gerson column that you wrote about. How does that relate to an argument about how young people should conduct their 20s, for example, or how does it relate to an argument about gay marriage, for example?
Well, I'll start with Crystal again, who, you know, in one of these interviews remarked, you know, here's something good that I have to say about the hippies. He said, unlike most people on the left, they're actually asking in public the question, what is the good way to live? Let's think fundamentally about the good life.
Right.
And he said, you know, this is an important question. This is an important conversation. It's one that we need to be able to have in public. Otherwise, it'll be anything goes or just a struggle for power. And, you know, I think he was really tipping his hand here as a believer in the basic premise of classical philosophy, which is, this is what philosophers do. This is what philosophy is. If you want to, you know, if you love wisdom, if you want to quest after wisdom, you ask other people in public about what the good life is, and then you have conversations about this. And if our ability to do that is eliminated from the public square, then we really are going to be living in a situation where it's a, you know, statist reality and libertarian fantasy. It so happens, I think, that those kinds of what is the good life questions nowadays seem to be at their most controversial when they apply to, you know, sort of moral questions of sexual conduct. You know, again, if you're going to be posing those kinds of questions and trying to persuade people one way or the other, you're going to be finding yourself, I think, in a situation where you're going to be appealing to them to look upward, aspirationally, in a noble sense, rather than look downward and say, oh no, don't stoop, you know, don't sink to this level. This level will destroy your dignity. So as far as this applies to Gerson, right? Gerson's argument
is so dignity is like don't don't sink this low in nobility is how high you can rise. Is that how you?
Yeah, and I think once you start framing things in that way, then the conversation, as we're used to hearing it from the right, gets modulated in some perhaps interesting ways. You know, Grissom comes out with his compassionate conservative bona fides and says, oh, isn't it terrible, isn't it tragic that all of these kids are having so much sex and they're waiting so long to get married and so on and so forth. And, well, you know, in, the truth is that you, if you go around the country, you can find some happy ending stories about kids like these, or you can find some really sad stories about kids like these. And I think one of the arguments that goes missing in Gerson's piece that I think might be an argument that people on the right will find to be to get them gain them some purchase is you know, we relax sexual mores in this way, we expose people to certain risks and costs, and it oftentimes turns out that those risks and costs can only be borne by people with a certain class, with a certain amount of economic wherewithal. And that it turns out that when you do throw open the gates for people to, you know, seek their own preferences and indulge in whatever sort of behaviors they want to, you'll find that there will be people basically who are well off enough, whether in terms of, you know, economic capital or cultural capital, to suffer those costs or to bear those costs without, you know, ruining their lives. And people who just aren't that well off to be able to indulge in these kinds of behaviors without throwing themselves seriously off track. Now, clearly that doesn't, you know, extend to something like gay marriage, but I think it does extend to the questions of, you know, sort of recreational drug use on a habitual level, and sexual promiscuity, and serial monogamy, and those sorts of things.
Right. I mean, I think that On the question of sexual behavior, it's not super relevant unless you have children. And obviously, if you have multiple children by multiple relationships at a young age, and you don't have a good economic foundation, that's not good for anybody. But I'm not sure. And that can be true. That can be true whether the relationships are marital or non-marital. There's a nice the term fragile families is a term that's sometimes used in social science that, you know, includes both married and unmarried families where there's not the economic basis or the relation or the strength of relationships to make those families work. But absent that, I don't think there's a major class difference between somebody who has, you know, sex with 20 people by the time they're 25, and somebody has sex with 2 people and marries the second.
I think we all know of people who are able to party their way through college and still, you know, land a job, and people who weren't, right? So obviously you can, you know, work really hard and also, you know, have sex with 20 people in college instead of 0 or 2. But, you know, I'd like to think of these things as coming in kind of a package deals. And that a young life dedicated to the pursuit of sort of hedonic pleasure is going to be the kind of thing that you can either afford to do and still come out being a productive member of society, or, you know, not be able to do so well.
Okay, but But it seems like that's leading you to say that even if you could do it and, you know, be a productive member, you know, even if the trust fund, you know, buys off
right.
any problems that you run into or whatever, you know, or you're John Edwards and you're able to con your supporters into solving your problems,
right.
You know, even if you have the financial resources to take care of everything, that you still shouldn't do it for reasons of, you know, that you still shouldn't live like that, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, take a look at a guy like John Edwards. You know, you go from dreaming of your second wedding with Dave Matthews Band 1 minute, which is, you know, not my idea of nobility, but hey, to being disgraced and pathetic the next minute. It's true that as Ross Douthat remarked a while ago in one of his columns, we're a very forgiving society, and we like to see people blow it, and then we like to forgive them, and we like to, you know, see them pick themselves back up. And in fact, you know, they may no longer have an ounce of nobility in their body, but you know, they've reclaimed their dignity. So in a way, the argument that I'm trying to lay out is a bit of an uphill battle in America, which is a country that is in love with seeing people reclaim their dignity, so long as, you know, they don't, so long as they're humbled, right?
Well, I mean, I don't know anybody, no matter what their attitudes are about, you know, sexuality, I don't know anybody who doesn't think that John Edwards is about the biggest scumbag they've ever seen. I mean, there's a critique to be made of this sense of morality, but it's a very clear-cut one. I mean, you know, telling the woman you're having an affair with that you'll marry her on a rooftop with the Dave Matthews Band after my wife dies is just, you know, that's just horrible. And it's no less horrible, you know, if you substitute Philip Glass for the Dave Matthews Band, it's still awful. It's atrocious, and I think everybody understands that's the kind of morality that matters. It's, you know, how you treat other people and how you treat your commitments and your relationships to other people, whether you treat commitments that you've made seriously or not. Not whether you make, you know, if somebody doesn't make a lot of commitments and you know, that doesn't sort of affect people. So I mean nobody's rushing to forgive John Edwards at all.
Obviously Edwards is a bit of an outlandish case, but I think that we're in a situation where people increasingly, you know, we want to be able to make commitments, but we want to be able to recalibrate those commitments sort of on the fly. I mean, look at, you know, for a slightly less sensationalistic example, look at a guy like Governor Sanford, right, who clearly, at least as far as we can tell, right, loves this Argentinian woman and found himself to be a married man in love with this Argentinian woman, and she was in love with him, and what do you do, right? I mean, it's not as clear-cut or slam dunk of a case as the John Edwards case from the perspective of the dominant culture today, I don't think. And, you know, there are a lot of people who I think would be inclined to say, you know, don't hide this. The only reason why you're hiding it is because you're a politician and we have this puritanical culture on the right that will hound you out of office if they discover that, you know, oh, heaven forbid, you should find yourself loving someone other than the person you're married to. You know, just end your marriage, go move to Buenos Aires and live happily ever after. You know, that's a different kind of scenario than the one that we see with Edwards, and I think people are more inclined to forgive on the grounds of you know, self-authenticity and romanticism and those kinds of things, even when they flagrantly violate commitments.
Because he sort of opened up.
He shared his true, you know, he shared his true feelings, and he was being sincere, and that's a kind of, you know, therapeutic confessional style that I think carries a lot of weight nowadays, even above and against some of the, you know, the commitments that we take to be of the sort that we make at our most serious.
I mean, obviously, I from an ethical viewpoint, I view Edwards and Sanford very differently, and of course, I also view them differently because Edwards is somebody whose basic political commitments I was sympathetic to, and you know, there's a certain amount I was always very undecided between, you know, I knew people whose just like gut instinct was he's a creep, he's a fraud, and people whose view was he's the only person talking about poverty, and I was kind of torn between those. And you know, in retrospect, I'm going to give an extra bonus points in the future to those people whose gut instinct was about Edwards was that he's a creep. Sanford I feel differently about, partly because, you know, he was trafficking in the same kind of social conservatism that he, I mean, it's almost like this other person came out in a crazy way. I mean, but he's not getting forgiven either. But I do see the point about the therapeutic culture versus the, you know, covered up at all costs culture. Obviously, in those situations, I mean, the other way to look at it is to say, when you see a situation like that, I mean, sometimes that's just inevitable, I suppose, in life, that somebody meets the true love of their life, and you know, in their 40s or whatever, into their marriage, or maybe it's, or sometimes people, you know, kind of come to terms with their own sexuality, and that destroys a marriage. I mean, that's reality. But you might also argue that the world that Michael Gerson wants to live in, where people get married at 22 or whatever, you know, probably creates more of those situations than if people have a little more time to kind of spread their wings and figure out what they're really about and who it is that they're most really going to, you know, that they're most going to be happy with. And if Mark, and maybe at some point Mark Sanford realizes, well, rather than having the, you know, the perfect wife for a political career in South Carolina, maybe I'm better off with, you know, a totally different kind of person. I mean, I don't really know much about the woman in Argentina. Maybe he should have just waited longer to do all those things. Maybe it's part of the argument against Gerson.
Well, yeah, you know, maybe so, maybe not. And you know, I think the point that I was working toward earlier was, you know, the romanticism on the right that says, let's make sure all our kids are married, you know, before they are of legal drinking age, and the romanticism on the left, which is let's make sure that, you know, our kids play the field until they're 38, and then they can, you know, settle down happily ever after. Both of these things are sort of silly dreams that don't really that don't really explain how it works out in real life with any kind of general reliability. You know, for some people, yes, you know, they will live the life of a playboy and they'll turn 40 and they'll say, now it's time for me to settle down, right, and live happily ever after. And some people will get married at 21 and live happily ever after.
The vast majority of people live their lives somewhere in between that.
Of course, right.
You know, and I mean, but how is that different from a kind of perfect moral relativism, which is not, you know, from, how is that different from just sort of saying, well, everybody's kind of lives a certain way? And we all know plenty of people who I think thought that they would be married at 25.
Yeah.
And as it happened, one thing or another happened, and it's 40, and they, you know, they lived with somebody for 3 years and it didn't work out. You know, one thing or another happened, and that didn't, that aspiration didn't happen. And in another case, somebody who, you know, they thought they were going to live that way, and either, you know, for whatever reason, they met the person, and that's where they are. I mean,
well, I think the implication of that kind of moral relativist position is, however it is that your life is now, and however it is that it turned out, you have no right to be disappointed with that life. You ought to be happy with it. There's nothing that you really could have done better. Don't let anyone, you know, try and put one over on you and make you think that, you know, if only you just sort of respected yourself a little bit more or something like that, then you might be in a position that feels better or is better. And of course, that's true, too. Right. You know, you don't want that kind of conversation to move, I'll put it this way, out of philosophy and into politics completely, right? Because when it moves fully into politics, then you start getting, I don't know. I mean, look at something like contract marriage, right? From one perspective, this is, you know, very conservative thing to do. This is a real commitment that you're making, and
you mean covenant marriage? Right.
You know, this is a serious commitment. And so we're going to make it, you know, we're going to sort of chisel it into the stone tablet here.
Right.
From another
perspective,
this one
really, really, really matters. Yeah.
Well, right. I mean, it's from another perspective, this is actually undermines the authority of those, what were once known as sacred commitments, because it plays right into the idea that the only thing that really carries authoritative force is political, is the law, or is political power. So we don't want that either, right? What we do want is a space in which people can tell stories about their lives in a way that permits them to acknowledge the things about them that wound up being disappointing and to say, hey, you know, other people, if you're interested in not being disappointed in the way that I've been disappointed, then you might want to think about doing this and not doing that.
Okay. I mean, I'm certainly fine with, you know, obviously, I mean, people will always have ways in which every path you take, there's another one you didn't take. There's a lot of room for disappointment, and I think there can be disappointments in all those situations. I don't necessarily follow that, you know, it justifies, you know, I mean, obviously, one can express that view, and plenty of people do. And Michael Gerson can express that view that I think the path to a better life is, you know, get married when, you know, in your 20s or your early 20s.
Well, but not just because it's his opinion, Right. I mean, the idea is to take the conversation to a place where people are advancing different points of view based on personal experience and lived evidence, rather than some ideological or abstract commitment to to purity in the abstract or to choice in the abstract. What we want is a conversation that's built around our however many generations this is, actual lived experience in the culture. And if every time we try to have that conversation, it becomes a matter of, well, hey, that's your opinion, man, or, well, everyone's opinion is as good as any other, then I think in a certain way that flies in the face of experience, in the same way that, you watch Mad Men and you say, oh, these people aren't living the good life. They are trying to live the good life, but in fact it's failing them or disappointing them. Or Revolutionary Road, to take another example.
Yeah,
we many of us today don't have any problem with saying that's not the good life, and we can do better than that. We should be able to make that same kind of judgment ourselves, and then have a conversation, a sort of judgment-laden exchange of views about the culture that we're living in today. And we don't. If that conversation is trapped in amber, is imprisoned by the fear that if I'm persuaded by my opponent about one aspect of this argument, I'm in danger of institutionalizing their point of view in politics and forcing it upon everyone else, then that's where we start turning into trouble.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess I can see. I mean, I have a little, to me, yeah. On the Washington Post op-ed page, one view is as good as another. E.J. Dionne's a little better. I read Gerson, and that's my attitude about it. Is okay. That's it. But it is a view of society as well as a view of what individuals should do, and it's certainly a view of women's lives and women's potential in a way that's that has very different implications from what it is for men. And so it's significant in a lot of ways, and those implications are, I'm happy to have the conversation about it, but it has to kind of include those implications as well for both women and men.
Right.
Making the most of their own lives as they want to do it, which, as you say, can take a lot of paths. And there are wrong paths. I'm not saying that there aren't wrong paths. I do think we have generally a kind of view of morality that's much more focused on the commitments one makes than what one actually does. So rather than that pure actual puritanical interest of one's actual behavior, it's really just a matter of, are you breaking commitments? How are you treating other people? Are you treating other people right or wrong? That obviously has a much higher standing in our view of in the kind of post-60s, post-70s view of general mainstream morality than it does than it did in in a Straussian world. And I guess your point comes down to, some people can handle that and some people can't, and that maybe that's socially destructive in certain parts of our society more so than in others. And to me that's an argument for not just addressing the economic inequalities, but rebuild, for what Rostathet and Rahan have argued for actually kind of rebuilding the economic foundations that do make it possible for people to pursue their own vision of life, and think more about the commitments, have a morality that's based on the commitments you make rather than the just the things you do.
Right. Well, and you can see that Ross and Rahan are very much following Crystal's path in their orientation of public policy around the idea of preserving the integrity of families.
Well, sure, but I mean, I think what they're doing with it makes a lot more sense than what Crystal did.
Because why exactly?
Because they're saying, government has a positive role to play in building those foundations of economic security.
Well, I mean, Crystal, in a way, the most important Crystal legacy is a comfort, a deep comfort on the right with a government that's spending lots of money on things. And when the despite the fact that, you know, let's put it this way, at every turn over the past 20 years, when it seems like military spending is going to be the largest chunk of the budget, right, whether it's the Iraq War or the Cold War or what have you, a few yards down the field, it turns out that that our domestic spending is going to, in fact, dwarf those large amounts. And people on the right have been more like Crystal in their willingness to tolerate that kind of exchange, and even to find some good things about the domestic spending, especially, you know, from the track record of the Bush administration, you see this being front and center. And less like, you know, less like the fiscal hawks and the libertarians who think that, you know, you're kidding yourself if you suppose that we can separate the political growth of government from the economic growth of government.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I guess we should probably wrap this up soon, but you kind of square the circle of a kind of conservatism that can be perfectly happy with Medicare Part D, perfectly happy with the bank bailout, as long as it kind of keeps the political order that they want, while still being opposed to most of what Obama's trying to do, versus the fiscal hawks, who are solely, which I don't know if that's a brand of conservatism or what. I mean, it's almost more of a, I know fiscal hawks who, in their other political commitments, range fairly widely. It's more of a kind of Washington mindset, I guess. So I can see that point. I guess I'm beginning to see the ways in which Crystal fits into that. I do think that in many ways, Crystal as the deal, you know, the deal maker among various factions of conservatism, and fitting them together, maybe with his own evolution, helping make that possible, I can't turn that phone off. It maybe is part of the story here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. And, you know, there's a counterfactual that would be great to spend even more time thinking about. Of course, no one really wants to watch two guys talking to each other for more than an hour nowadays, and for good reason. But, you know, if Crystal had doubled down on the Democratic Party, and if, you know, Bell and Glaser and the others had managed to keep their neoconservative band on the left and not on the right, we'd be living in a much different country. And, you know, there are all sorts of reasons why that didn't happen. But
right.
Perhaps the tragedy of neoconservatism is that, you know, in a lot of ways, I do think it is the mainstream position in American political life. And it's taken a beating as a result from both the right and the left as partisan politics has become more and more polarized. The attempt of the Crystals of the world to build a coalition with the populist right in a way that would lead not just to electoral victory, but to the kind of cultural policies that they thought were crucial to the basic integrity of civilization, led them down a road where I think they were surprised to discover that these conservative populists were able to produce individual leaders of their own who, through force of charisma or other things, were able to get themselves into positions of power where they could say, okay, Irving Crystal, that's really interesting monograph that you've written, but I'm the decider, and this is the way it's going to go.
Right. Well, I think that's a very, very articulate way of putting it, and I think brings out a question of whether, in making those deals, Crystal, in a sense, sold out some of that original neoconservatism. I don't get a sense in either him or his son that there's any hesitation about having done that, and I guess that's one of the differences I have. Your counterfactual, by the way, is the famous, you know, if only Henry M. Scoop Jackson had been the Democratic nominee for president in 1972
right.
or 1976, everything would have been different. Which always is, you know, it's not like what always bothers me about that counterfactual. Obviously, they're bigger culture. You know, you're talking about something bigger than just that. But that's how it's usually put. And it's, you know, it would be a little credible if Scoop Jackson had been, you know, on his way to the nomination and been, you know, had his knees cut out from under him or something like that. You know, he won one primary and was a very bad candidate.
Right.
It's not a very close in counterfactual, but it is. I mean, it is possible to see that tendency remaining within the Republic, within the Democratic Party, and having continued to play a bigger role in the Democratic Party, even though it's not always relevant. I mean, obviously, it's relevant to winning the Florida primary in 1976. Not necessarily, I think, always relevant to the politics of either party.
Right.
Even though in some ways it is, I guess, I think you've persuaded me that it's more of a mainstream, you know, mainline viewpoint than maybe I thought it was.
Even if it's, you know, sort of the messy middle,
right.
You know, when you line up where most Americans seem to be at, I think that, you know, in spite of it all, right, in spite of the Bush years, the general neocon position is one that seems to, I don't know if I want to say work better, because I don't want to make it a pragmatist point, but it's one that Americans, I think, find themselves coming back to time and time again in a way that can't just be coincidence, but is something that should cause us all to think, to continue to think about what, not just, you know, what Crystal's legacy is and where neoconservatism is headed, because, you know, I don't think it's dead.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think that's, I guess I'm not fully with you, but it's definitely got me thinking, and I think it makes a lot of sense when you think about the original public interest viewpoint of neoconservatism, which is in many ways a fairly pragmatic vision. This certainly got me thinking.
Well, I suppose we should wrap up.
Yeah, let's wrap up. We didn't talk about healthcare, budget reconciliation, Joe Wilson, any of that stuff. That's fine, though. It's a fascinating conversation.
Agreed.
Okay. Thanks, James.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
Bye.